I am delighted now to welcome to the program Simon Dedeo. He is an Omidyar Fellow at the Santa Fe Institute, and he is going to be introducing a film. It's part of a new series. It's a series on science and film, and Valerie Plame is here. She is, I believe, Director of Community Outreach at the Santa Fe Institute, and Jason Silverman is the director of the CCA Cinematheque. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe. And Jason just got here. Welcome.
Good morning.
Now, let's talk for a moment about this film series that's happening at the CCA. How did you all come up with this idea?
Well, Jason came to Santa Fe Institute and made it the pitch. I'm the head of community outreach at the Institute, which means I'm constantly looking for ways to get people to think about the Institute and make it perhaps a little less intimidating. And I'm particularly fascinated at the nexus of art and science. And Jason came in, along with your executive director and a board member, and said, here's this program that is wildly popular elsewhere in the nation, science on the screen, and this could be something that we could apply here. So we made a couple twists that make it fit our community best, and this is what we've come up with. We found four very generous sponsors. We're going to be doing it this spring, starting tomorrow night. And what we did, we went to the researchers and staff and faculty at the Institute and said, here's our idea. Let us know if there's something that has sparked your interest, a film that made you think again about your research, what you do, how it inspired you. And we're very fortunate to have as our first lecturer, Simon Dedeo, and he'll be doing War Games.
So did you choose this film, War Games?
Yes. It's funny Valerie says science and art because it's an extremely silly movie, as you know.
Okay, low art.
Well, I watched it last night, I have to say, and it might be an extremely silly movie, but I was on the edge of my seat because I had never seen it before. It came out in 1983, nearly 30 years ago, and for what it is, it's good.
It's enormously influential. It's a film that not only, I saw it when I was probably about 12 years old, and so it was my first encounter with these kinds of concepts that we'll talk about tomorrow, but it's also been influential just in the culture of computer hackers, computer nerds. A lot of terms that we use to talk about how people access systems, they break into them, come from that film, which is amazing.
Hackers,
is that right?
In the news au courant.
Absolutely, yeah.
The word hacker comes from the film.
No. So hacker, that's a word that's lost in the mystery of time, probably
okay.
The 1970s. But war dialing, which is a theme that comes up in the movie, the way that Matthew Broderick's character finds these unknown systems, is something that's in the sort of technical literature now. It's called war driving. If you look for Wi-Fi networks, you drive around in your car to find unsecured systems. So not only is it sort of a playful film, but I think it's also something that really hooked into a moment at the time, and it has a lasting effect on the hacker culture today.
It's a real Cold War era film. I mean, it was during that time where everybody was pretty sure we were going to fight a war against the Russians, probably a nuclear war against the Russians. And the tension that was part of our basic daily existence is, I think, present in that movie.
It's interesting, actually, because you can compare it to Dr. Strangelove.
I know.
Right, and so I think it's a beautiful thing, actually. There's two pictures of rationality. In Dr. Strangelove, you have this game theory, mutually assured destruction, the doomsday machine. But by the time you get to 1983, it's sort of funny, right? It's the Cold War, but it's sort of the jovial Cold War. And so you get a very different picture of rationality. Of it's much more playful. The machine wants to play a game. It doesn't want to destroy the world. And that's I think, a shift that happens in the film there. So.
But in any movie of that kind, including War Games and including Dr. Strangelove, you've got some kind of beefy guy with a southern accent who's ready to push the button.
But even this guy is actually quite a human person, right? He's a very human character. He's a cigar chomping guy who believes in people. And the film, I think, asks who is a person in a very deep sense. And the cigar-chomping guy turns out in some ways to be on the right side of history, in a way.
And you're using satire, like Dr. Strangelove, to illuminate a far scarier prospect, which is nuclear war, and to have people think about it in a different way rather than just hiding under a desk for cover, as they did in the 50s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And I think when something is so daunting and so huge and so, on some level, incomprehensible as nuclear war, namely, somebody can drop a large piece of metal out of an airplane and turn 5 million people into dust and humidity, that's not...
It's just, we the human mind cannot comprehend.
Yeah, and so...
And a movie like this is a way of showing a piece of that and having people absorb it and internalize it and go, really? Is that what they're talking about?
Right. And I think also the fact that a kid played by an adorable Matthew Broderick, who looks, you can't not think of Ferris Bueller every time you look at him, but anyway, that a kid could somehow, and it hasn't gone away, as we all know, break into machines that they really shouldn't have access to and change a whole lot of things.
There was just a program on 60 Minutes on the other night on the Stuxnet worm, mm-hmm. that computer program, probably disseminated through USB, that had a very detrimental effect on Iranian centrifuges. And
is that right?
Oh, it's fascinating. They have shut down quite a few of the centrifuges in Iran. No one, of course, has taken responsibility for it, but it was probably done by a large intelligence service who was motivated to do so, of which, you can imagine who those...
Let me think.
Yeah, who would that be? It's probably the Dutch. No. I think this is what the story talked about, and War Games is a prelude to, is it's a Pandora's box. Cyber warfare goes both ways, of course, of how you can... you can destroy an enemy, but that also opens up the possibility that it can be the retribution. I mean, it takes a couple smart people to figure out the code. Stuxnet was incredibly complex, and they still haven't quite figured it all out, but it did have a desired effect.
Yeah, and it also brings up the question of what we mean by enemy when you are talking about killing entire cities.
That's different versus a nuclear program in a... rogue nation state.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Now, when you look at this film, I mean, did you just watch it recently, Simon?
I actually did. I hadn't seen it for, as I said, since I was maybe 12 years old, and so I saw it again, and cinematography has changed. The pace of movies has changed, even. So this is a movie for kids, and it seems really contemplative by modern standards, actually. So, It's a very funny film. Actually, as a very sort of odd fact, it was originally directed by the man who would go on to direct Gigli.
Oh, really?
The worst movie of all time.
That's unfortunate.
But he was actually pulled from the film. There's a couple scenes that he directed, and they brought in a different director. So,
I guess it's contemplative compared to the kind of incredibly fast cut, quickly cut movies that we see today that are not in time sequence, and we're trying to figure out half the time what is even going on in the first place, and all comes together at the end, or Inception or something like that, where you have to see it three times before you even really have put the whole thing together. But at the same time, this is the question that I want to ask you, and ask all of you, but particularly Simon, from the science point of view. In what ways is the film dated? And obviously, when you look at these computer terminals and the way that they're writing code and stuff like that, it's okay. But in what ways is the film dated, and in what ways is it not?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, the how fast computers work, how large they are, has changed. I looked at the fastest computer in 1983 was the Cray XMP. If you look, an iPhone today is about 100 times faster. So a machine that you could pay $10 million for in 1983, that was close to being a weapon, today is a machine that we would even throw out after a year of use, after 6 months. And so in one sense, of course, the film is an absolute, you know, time capsule of how things used to work. In another sense, and it's a sort of wonderful fact, is that the personalities and the way we think about machines, that hasn't changed very much at all. We're still asking, I think, the same questions. We're asking questions about how much of war, how much of society should we give over to the machine? How much can we automate? We're still very nervous about it. I mean, if you look at the cigar-chomping Southern general, you know, he says, well, how can you take war out of the hands of my men? And today we ask the same questions. How can you take the car out of my control?
Or look at drones.
Or drones.
Absolutely,
exactly.
Yeah. How can
change
you
change the whole nature of warfare?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think this is, I mean, we even ask it, you know, how can you take your social life and put it on a computer? How can you let Facebook decide whose face you're going to see in the morning when you log on? So those questions, I think, are absolutely eternal. Ever since we've had machines, we've had to ask these questions. And I think the reactions that you have from the characters towards these machines is, again, very similar. I mean, the Matthew Broderick character, this sort of amoral guy, he wants to play. He wants to have fun. He doesn't care if he's writing Stuxnet or if he's leaking, you know, WikiLeaks. If he's, you know, sending out diplomatic cables. He doesn't care. He just wants to play.
Well, and also, I mean, you know, the poor guy, he's a teenager. You know, he hasn't probably developed the kind of moral framework that you expect in people who are doing this kind of stuff for a living.
You hope, anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, you hope.
That develops.
Perhaps you could speak to that, Valerie Plame, former CIA.
My moral compass is fine.
I don't mean you. I mean, as an institution, when you're working in these giant bureaucracies whose job is basically to, quote-unquote, keep us safe, there is the larger mission, and then there is ego that is a continual factor.
Absolutely. In my time in the CIA, I developed an expertise in counterproliferation. That's what I focused on, and I derived a great sense of satisfaction from that. So, and I never was asked or felt that I needed to do something that went against my moral grain. So I never had to face that dilemma. But these are huge questions. For, you know, how, go back for a moment to Stuxnet. Yes, it did have the desired effect of at least delaying the Iranian nuclear program. It was discovered, so it did not fully blossom into what I'm sure the code writers and organizers behind it had hoped for. But again, it opens up the door to having that come back against us. As we know, America is very vulnerable to cyber attacks, be it from our power grid to the ATMs to the water. And so as we forge ahead into this new world, of which War Games is, you know, a little prelude to that, these are the questions that we need to, you just hope that those that are in decision-making capacities have a very clear view of what they're doing and their moral responsibilities. That's what only you can hope for in a democracy.
Hope is the operative word.
Mm-hmm. I love that Matthew Broderick, Ali Sheedy film can get us into deep conversation like this on a Wednesday morning.
Well, the Ali Sheedy character is so pathetic, you can't even, I mean, this is a way in which you can really see that things have changed. A big-haired, ditzy teenage girl whose entire contribution is lines like, gee, what's that little button there?
What's this one do? Yeah, well, this is the whole idea of the series, though, is to use these films that we all love, sometimes we make a little bit of fun of, and use them to enter some deeper dialogue. There's so much interesting work happening at the Institute, and people like us don't necessarily have access to it.
That's what you had said about KSFR being such a pillar of the community. I always think I'm a relatively new citizen of Santa Fe. There's lots of towns of 70,000 or so. No, none of them come close to what Santa Fe offers in terms of rich intellectual depth and culture and art. KSFR, CCA, Santa Fe Institute, I dare say, are at the vanguard of all of those and what makes people come and stay in this community. I love that we're using pop culture, movies, sometimes silly, sometimes they're not. We'll talk more about the other ones that are coming up. But as a platform to talk about some of the really big ideas and cutting-edge science that's going on at the Institute. And my hope is that when people come out and they learn a little bit more about CCA, they learn a little bit more about SFI, they go, huh, I'm going to go check out their future programs. I didn't know it could be so fun and interesting.
Simon DeDeo, what do you do at the Santa Fe Institute?
I guess it's funny, we were just talking about this, but we spend a lot of time playing. It's a very playful environment there. We don't have restrictions on what we work on. We don't have restrictions on what we think. It doesn't have to pay off. I did my PhD in physics in 2005, and I came to the Institute because I wanted to work on different problems, on difficult problems. And so I began in physics. Physics is a very clean subject now. It's sort of what they call the spherical cow. But I work now.
Wait, you just said the word a spherical cow?
Yes. So this is an old joke, right? There's a dairy farmer, and he wants to increase his yield, and so he hires a biologist. And you know, the biologist says, "Look, I can breed your cow. It'll take 200 years. They'll make the greatest milk." And he says that's not fast enough. And so he calls different people in, and he finally gets to the physicist, and the physicist says, "Look, I've done the calculations. I've solved your problem. There's a couple sort of minor mathematical assumptions, but really, it begins with this. Assume a spherical cow in a vacuum is the follow-up. But in any case, the idea is...
I heard that same joke as an economist. They're trying to open a can on a desert island, and when they finally get to the economist, they say, assume you have a can opener.
Exactly. Yeah, in fact, actually, physicists and economists are the two most arrogant fields in academia. But in any case, I came to the Institute because I wanted to work on messier problems. I wanted to work on social problems, biological problems, where we don't have the mathematical tools as polished as we've had in physics. Biology, in some sense, if you date physics to Isaac Newton, you date biology to Charles Darwin, probably the first serious scientific as opposed to sort of taxonomic approach. It means that biology is maybe 200 years younger. So, it's 1812 right now. If you're a biologist, which is a fantastic time to be.
Very interesting. So when you say you wanted to come and work on some difficult and messy problems, like what?
So the first set of problems I worked on when I came here was actually conflict, and conflict in an animal system. So if you look at the primates, which are very close to us.
Which are us.
Just about, yeah, just about. So we worked on monkeys, and you can do things to monkeys that you can't do to people, which is helpful in some cases. But we looked at why they fought, the ways in which they fought and why they fought. And I've talked about this once before in KSFR, but, we have these folk theories of conflict. When we ask why people fight, we tend to say it's about resources. So we talk about wars for oil, we talk about wars for water. And what was fascinating was if you look at conflict in the animal world, it's not even true there. So animals don't fight, at least the more sophisticated animals, don't fight directly over resources. We looked at a community of animals, a community of pigtail macaques, kind of monkey. And they live in a university pen. They have all the food they need. There's no resource constraints, and yet they fight. And so we asked, well, why? And what that led us into was a series of questions about social behavior, about the goals and needs that animals have that turn out to be amazingly sophisticated.
So what did you come up with?
Yeah.
Well,
Is it popularity?
It turns out relationships matter. That's the broad answer. I think the more technical answer is that pairwise relationships matter. And so the way we sort of phrase that in the end, we it's a lot of sophisticated mathematics, of course, very hard. In the end, it comes down to this, and so I worked with David Krakauer and Jessica Flack, and they're amazing researchers, and they're also married. And so I said, imagine you see your wife in a bar, and she's in a fight. Do you get involved? And, well, it really depends. If she's in a fight with some random person you've never seen, of course you get involved. But if she's in a fight with her mother, probably not. And so the way in which conflict is driven by human relations, that it's not simply a binary decision, that it's about the entire social context that you inhabit. It's true for people, certainly, and it's also true for our nearest intellectual neighbors, the primates, the monkeys, and the apes. So,
how do you think about the fact that when you're studying these primates, that they're in an enclosure which is not really their natural habitat, that it's sort of an artificial situation, which is maybe analogous to artificial situations that we might find ourselves in, for example, you know, jail or something like that. Where people behave differently in jail than they do in a free community.
It's interesting. So the research station that the data comes from is at Emory University, and it's dedicated in large part to the study of the animals' sort of natural behaviors. They live in a large sort of football field sized enclosure, so that's not quite a natural system. In the natural world, half that group would be on the other hill, and so you wouldn't be able to see them. So it's a bit of a compromise between trying to put them into an organic situation that sort of reflects the worlds in which they evolved to survive in, but at the same time making it accessible to observation by scientists.
We're talking to Simon Dedeo from the Santa Fe Institute, and it's funny, are people not considered primates?
So I am still a physicist, so I can't give you a straight answer for that. What strikes me is the intellectual and even moral sophistication that you see in animals in general. And the more you work on it, the more you look at how they're behaving, the more you accept that, okay, it's going to look different, it's not going to be obvious, but the mathematics tells you that they are... In many ways, let me put it this way: there's a wonderful pair of scientists who work on bonobos, and they often talk about Jane Austen and the social complexity of an English village when they look at these sort of communities of 30, 40 animals.
Yeah.
So they are sophisticated. They are like us in many ways.
And why wouldn't they be?
I
think one of the It seems to me, and I mean, I don't do what you guys do, but as that one of the paradigm shifts that we seem to be going through as a species is seeing ourselves back. In a way, it's sort of probably going backwards to maybe more of an indigenous way of thinking, but seeing ourselves as part of nature and as manifestations of nature, as opposed to merely observers of it or outside of it.
Exceptional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that, I mean, there's a lovely feature, and this sort of brings it back to war games, is on the one hand, we get better at understanding how animals behave. They look more like us. And on the other hand, we start to ask, well, you know, could we make things that are like us? Could we make machines that think, that reason, that have moral value as well? So it's almost like our exceptionalism is being crushed from both sides. It's being crushed from our contact with nature, and it's also being pushed by our contact with technology.
Do you see how lucky I am to spend some time at the Santa Fe Institute? This is what I get to talk about when I sit down at lunch.
Exactly.
And it's across the board. It's fascinating.
So you were working, Simon, on this whole area of conflict. Are you still in that?
So that was my first introduction to a set of themes that have come up for me and some colleagues of mine at the Institute, which is the idea of looking at nature as if it were an engineered object, and in particular, look at how it processes information, how it, in some sense, is a computation. We know how machines behave. We have 100 and 150 years of theory about how computers work, and the question is, can we take some of those theories and apply them to the natural world? Can we find, in some sense, sort of natural-born computers? So that gets into a whole series of questions that it leads you to study human systems from a computational standpoint. One way to look at conflict, for example, is you're trying to solve a problem. The problem is who should lead the group, who should be the high status people in that group. And you could put that into a spreadsheet and answer the question that way. How does nature do it? It doesn't have a spreadsheet. And so maybe some of these conflict mechanisms are, you know, in part about physical force, they're in part about violence, but they're also part of a problem-solving algorithm that evolution has produced just naturally.
And to decode that is no small feat.
It's terrifically exciting, right? It's reverse engineering nature. It's trying to find the source code in some sense of the natural world, to look under the hood. And it's a beautiful thing.
David Krakauer was on the air last year, and after we finished doing the interview, I said to him, David, you guys are a fairly sizable bunch of super-duper brainiacs up at the Institute. Why don't you figure out how to get people to stop fighting with each other? Just make that your priority. Why don't you do that? He goes, oh, Mary Charlotte, that's politics. Politics is impossible to study because you have politicians and you ask them questions and they lie, so you can't get any data.
It seems like there's a theme running through the series that has to do with using science and research to understand things that might otherwise be incomprehensible.
Now, Valerie Plame Wilson, one of the things about the movie War Games is that it reminds us that in 1983, the United States and the Soviet Union had major missiles pointed at each other 24/7, 365 days a year, with bunches of men with their fingers near bunches of buttons ready to attack each other. What does it look like now?
I'm afraid the vision has only gotten darker. We, in fact, still have hundreds of nuclear weapons ready at on trigger alert, pointed at Moscow. I mean, our nuclear doctrine, which is in the process of being reworked, but it is very much a relic of the Cold War. It was as if when the Cold War, when the Berlin Wall fell, the Cold War was over, everyone collectively went, phew, well, we don't have to worry about that anymore. But what has happened, in fact, in the ensuing years, and it always sort of twists my mind when I'm speaking to university students, that some of them were not even alive when the Cold War ended. So this is really ancient history. But what has happened is the nuclear technology has proliferated. We have the emergence, of course, of the significant terrorist threat that are Al-Qaeda and its various affiliates are absolutely trying to acquire a nuclear weapon. And more are in the nuclear club. And why? Because it is still perceived as, you know, you're in the big boys club with nuclear weapons. And so it is unfortunately worse now than it was under a bipolar regime. And I'm working with a group called Global Zero that is what I love. It is very nonpartisan and stretches from Henry Kissinger on the right all the way. It's not just some liberal, let's hold hands and hope for the best. They are working along with world leaders, prime ministers, generals, students, political leaders to get us to a world that ultimately eliminates nuclear weapons, because we cannot continue on the path we are. It's just a question of when, not if.
One of the things, and maybe you can, Simon, speak to the way this does or doesn't work in non-human species, but one of the things that I think is the simplest principle that any of us can live by is the golden rule. You do things to others that you want done to them, and you don't do things to others that you don't want them to do to you, basically. And there was this amazing moment during the South Carolina Republican primaries where Ron Paul gets on the air and says, in terms of foreign policy, we shouldn't do anything that we don't to others that we don't want them to do to us. And the whole auditorium went boo. And Jon Stewart that night got on the television and said, note this day that South Carolina came out against the golden rule. And I was thinking, why is that not a basic principle? It's so easy to follow. It makes so much sense. We're all people. It's all about a kind of fairness and equality. Do you see any of that playing out in nature, Simon?
It's a fantastic question. I think, and this is a sort of a theory that has come up over the years, that in fact something like the golden rule, or in a more general term, the ability to take the perspective of somebody else.
Oh, empathy.
Empathy. I mean, of course, you know, people say that psychopaths have empathy, and they use it in the wrong way, of course. But the idea that being able to take the perspective of somebody else is in some sense foundational for the level of intelligence that enables us to build machines, computers. We used to think that intelligence was essentially a mathematical faculty, a combinatoric faculty. But if you look, it's the social animals, the animals that have to take the perspective of others to survive. It's those species that become the most cognitively sophisticated, the ones that live in groups, the ones that essentially, in order to survive, they have to say, well, what does Mary want, right? What does Valerie want? What would I want if I were her? And even sort of the higher level things of what does she think that I want, and so forth. That actually turns out, and I think a case can be made, it's not yet a scientific theory, but it's the beginning of one that says essentially that we're driven by our social cognitive needs. And so in some sense, I think you're absolutely right that intelligence begins there.
It's funny because you are talking about intelligence, and intelligence is something that's hard to define. As you say, it's not just computation. It's not just the ability to build sophisticated machines. And it's also interesting to me that empathy is something that some highly intelligent people really don't have, and some very not that bright but lovely people do have.
High EQ.
Yeah, if you can.
Emotional quotient.
Yeah.
We certainly pay money for certain kinds of intelligence. So we rate very highly the ability to program a computer, for example. Although I don't think there's many people, for example, in our government who can program computers, and they do very well. So another way, we also do reward people with great empathy. I mean, look at someone like Bill Clinton, right? Mm-hmm. He's somebody whose emotional intelligence is off the charts. He's an Einstein of it. Mm-hmm. We rate things. I think about Henry James novels, right? I mean, I can do general relativity. I have a lot of trouble reading, you know, something like The Golden Bull. It's an enormously complicated novel. And at the same time, I think it's a realistic novel. I think some people are able to live their lives at that level of not just compassion, but also this perspective taking. I know that you know that I know, and so on down the line. And to be able to live their lives at that level of sort of unity with others is an amazing faculty that people do have.
Why does it become harder when there's a lot of power at stake?
Well, your comment about South Carolina and hooting and hollering against Ron Paul and lack of empathy, I think in the political sphere, I can't speak to nature, but in the political sphere, I think it's fair to say that there is a strong trend of American exceptionalism that says that we can do and say and act in ways that are different from the rest of the world because we're bigger and stronger. And as, to use Friedman's term, you know, as the world flattens, if you will, and other powers are rising, all those assumptions are going to have to be reassessed, and it makes a lot of Americans really angry not to be told that they are not absolutely the best at everything. And it's going to, we are entering a phase now, at least politically, I think, where we need to reexamine all the assumptions that got us to the top of the heap. If in the world, international terms, after World War II. We're going to have to be much more empathetic and in order to achieve our ends and maintain our national security. We're going to have to figure out, why is it they don't like us?
Now, when you say, okay, a lot of people say, well, we're the biggest and strongest, and therefore nobody should be able to, we should be able to do whatever we want whenever we want. Is there a parallel to that in primate communities that you've looked at? Do the big monkeys say, I can do whatever I want?
It's actually one of the video clips I use when I give a talk on this is a very big monkey getting beat up by two small ones. When you look, the more cognitively sophisticated the species is, the less things like physical size matter. In some sense, we talk about soft power a lot, right? Was it our nuclear weapons or was it jazz that ended the Cold War? And I think it can go either way. Certainly, no one dropped a bomb on Cairo, but things changed a great deal. And soft power exists in the animal world. In some sense, being able to manipulate soft power, being able to leverage it, is perhaps part of what leads us to become as brainy, I think, as we are. So,
and as countries become ever more reliant upon technology and true brain power rather than physical brute force, you know, you don't have to pull a wagon, you don't have to load hay. It has a tendency also to equalize the genders. Mm-hmm. As we know, I think more women are graduating from college than men, and they have a higher percentage in law schools and so forth. And we're seeing that playing out in highly developed industrialized nations.
when you said the thing about jazz, it reminded me of my dear mother, who I think is listening right now, who told me once that she escaped from communist East Germany after World War II, and her whole family did, one by one. They left Berlin. They went from the Eastern Zone to the Western Zone. And when asked why she left, she said three reasons: Glenn Miller, Benny Goodman, and Tommy Dorsey.
And that has extraordinary pull. Soft power has extraordinary powers. When you see pictures of contemporary streets in Tehran, I'm always taken where, if you didn't know, it would look just like the village. You know, the kids are walking around in their sneakers and their cool shades, but superimposed on that is an extremely repressive regime, and it'll be interesting to see how that dynamic plays out.
Jason Silverman is the director of the CCA Cinematheque. Simon Dedeo is Omidyar Fellow at the Santa Fe Institute, and Valerie Plame Wilson is the director of community outreach there. Thank you all so much for being with us today on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.